Tape 1, Side 1. Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. My name is Mildred J. Menlo. With my colleague, Ruth Weiner, we are interviewing Hans Jonas. The interview is taking place at Mr. Jonas' home on October 27th, 1995.
I'm Hans Jonas. I was born December 25th, 1926 in Vienna, Austria. My mother was Sabina Kellenbrunn.
Can you spell it?
Kellenbrunn. She was born before 1900, I would guess around 1895. She was a concert pianist, went to the Conservatory of Vienna. My father was born on January 1, 1890. His name was Herman, and he was a photographer in Vienna, as was his father before him. I had one sister. She was born on March 3rd, 1931. Well, 5 years older. And
her name?
In Vienna. She died about 4 or 5 years ago.
What was her name, please?
Her name was Valerie Jonas. Her married name was Valerie Stadler, S-T-A-D-L-E-R. Her husband's parents were also from Vienna. And although we hardly knew each other there, when they met here in Pittsburgh, that's how the connection...
His name was...
His name was Marcel Stadler, M-A-R-C-E-L-L. And I don't remember my grandparents except my mother's mother, who in her earlier life was a high school principal. Kind of unusual in those days.
What was her name?
Clara. K-L-A-R-A.
K?
Clara.
Not with a C?
Not with a C, with a K. And my oldest daughter was named after her, Carol.
You talked about your brother-in-law, but what did he do?
He was in the hotel business in Florida, and he's retired now.
I want to talk about your early years growing up.
How about the children first?
We'll get to our
children?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have three daughters. One is Carol. She lives in Florida. She's married to a French chef. Her name is Carol Jonas Tasic, T-A-S-I-C. I have my second daughter is Marla, M-A-R-L-A. And she is a lot of things. She's a music teacher. She is a photographer. She also works for the film industry. As a matter of fact, she's working on a film now at St. Philomena's.
Oh, really? Oh, that would be great. So you have her here.
She's a tutor.
Our youngest daughter is Amy, and she's married to a young man named Kenneth Mangurton, M-A-N-G-U-R-T-E-N. They live on Tilbury Street. They have two children.
What are the names?
Jack and Julie.
Her husband's name?
Is Kenneth.
Kenneth.
Kenneth Mangurton.
And he does?
He's a social worker.
Both of them have a master's.
Both are social workers.
And Jack and Julie are how old?
Jack is about 9 months old, yeah. And Julie is about 3.5 years old.
That takes care of your immediate.
Right.
You just had the one sister. Okay. Let's go back to the earliest days that you can remember of your childhood. Where did you go to school?
I was born in Vienna.
You were born in Vienna.
Right. December 25th, 1926. And my father had two studios in Vienna, one that was a holdover from the emperor's days.
Franz Joseph I,
right. And he was what they called Kaiserliche Königliche Hoffotograf, which was purveyor to the emperor, among other photographers. He was one of them.
What did that mean?
That meant that, you know, like the Queen of England, you see on the scotch bottles, you know, purveyor to the Queen, that you get the seal.
He was
the photographer for the royal family. The royal family was extensive. And he had a partner in this business. And that studio was downtown. And that's where all the royalty came, all their descendants, all the counts and the dukes, and then we had a second studio in a working class section, like our north side. That's the one that made money.
I'm sure of that.
And that studio was the one that I remember more distinctly. After World War I, my grandfather sent my father to the United States. He wanted him to gain experience here, photographic experience. And he had an uncle here. He was my great uncle, so he was my father's brother. And his name was Simon Jonas. And
In Pittsburgh.
And he was married to a woman.
Burke.
Yeah, Burke. There was a Jewish family, B-U-R-K. They had a Burke's Auto Stores. And his wife, as part of her dowry, was one of the stores. In Hazelwood. So my father came to Pittsburgh to be with his uncle and got a job working in a studio here in Pittsburgh. And he was single and he had red hair and he was quite good looking. And so everybody wanted him to get married here. Well, he felt that the women in this country dominated the men. So he decided to go back. He saved his money, and he went back. And then, about 1924, five, you know. And when Hitler came, I had a normal childhood. I went to school. We always had a cook at home. We had a woman that took care of the children, because my mother was either at the studio or she was playing piano. And when Hitler came, my father had a sister in Budapest. And she called him up and said, you know, why don't you come down to Budapest for a few days and see what happens? You know, Hitler's coming in. And at that time, nobody thought anything would happen. It was just another government. It didn't mean a great deal. But my father said, look, I'm a veteran of World War I. He had an Iron Cross. What could happen to me? So he didn't go. And what really happened in 1934, there was an attempt to overthrow the government, backed by the Nazis. And they assassinated the chancellor. His name was Dollfuss. Well, Dollfuss was one of our D-O-L-F-U-S-S. Dollfuss was one of our accounts. And I remember his children very vaguely. I mean, I was, 7 years old. You can't remember when you're seven. And then after Dollfuss was shot, the government was stable and stabilized because Mussolini said that if a German comes across the border, he was going to invade Germany. And at that time, Hitler wasn't so strong. So he pulled back, and they elected a man named Schuschnigg, S-C-H-U-S-C-H-N-I-C-K, something like that, who was the chancellor who made a deal with Hitler that Germany, Austria would be absorbed by the greater German empire, and he left. And he came to the United States. No, Schuschnigg did. And he came to the United States and he was teaching at a university here. Yeah, European history. And he was a customer, so my father didn't think anything was going to happen. And what did happen is that it was 1938. Everybody was just coming out of a depression. So was every country, including European countries. And they decided that in order for these unemployed people, Austrians, Gentile Austrians, to have jobs, it would be best to get the Jews out of that job and put a Gentile in. In addition to that, if there was a Jewish anything, a department store, a hardware store, photographic studio, anything, they would bring someone in from the party and he would become the leader, the manager of this store. It was called Arische Leitung.
Literally take over.
That's it. And what they did is they told you, take your hat and leave. That's it. Just go away. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, this was also done legally. The Germans were they were sticklers for legality. Everybody that was in a concentration camp, there was a record of him. And somebody signed for him when they took him, wherever they took him. There was an absolute wonderful record. That's why the Nuremberg trials were so good, because they had absolute perfect records. So we got an Arische Leitung, and naturally that meant that we were finished. And this was in the summer of 38. And the handwriting was on the wall. And so my father wrote to Uncle Simon here in Pittsburgh and said, we want to come to the United States. So you had to get an affidavit. You had to get a statement from someone here in the U.S. that would say that this man will not become a burden to the government. And there was a quota system, as with every country. So many Austrians and so many Greeks and so many Yugoslavians can come into the United States. There were two countries that you could go to if you didn't have anybody. You could go to Bolivia, or you could go to Manchuria. Bolivia and Manchuria wanted brain power. So you could go to the Bolivian or Manchurian embassy and get an exit permit. And then you couldn't take anything with you except personal effects. Your furniture, but no jewelry and no furs and no money, no insurance policy, nothing. Everything was frozen. All the savings and all the checking account and whatever was frozen by the government. That's it. But everybody always saved dollars. And so if you had dollars, then you could go and on the black market, and you know, everybody had dollars at home. That was a wonderful stable currency. Some people also had pound sterling. When Kristallnacht came, and what happened in Paris was a Jewish man shot the third secretary at the German embassy in Paris. And so Germany took this as a vehicle to let loose on all the Jews all over the Germany and Austria. And what they did, they blamed all the Jews for this assassination. And not only that, but they demanded from the Jewish population in both Germany and Austria, which was now one country, huge amount of money. So how can we give you the money if you took it all? That's your problem. Okay? And so that's the night that they burned all the synagogues and took thousands of them, 40,000, I think, to these concentration camps. Now, nobody knew what that was. See? Nobody, you also have to know that this was not at the time where they were absolutely, they didn't have the ovens, they didn't kill anybody outright. They did kill a lot of people, but not systematically. And these people that were picked up during Kristallnacht, they were the ones that really built the camps. Some of the camps were built already, but not to this extent. So they would cut trees, and they would make timber, and they built barracks. And you were allowed to write one postcard every month.
You didn't tell them your father was picked up.
Yeah, my father was one of the people picked up. So when he didn't come home from the studio, or wherever he was. No, that was already after the studio was gone. He didn't come home, so there was turmoil in the streets, you know, they're burning the synagogue. So the day afterwards, my mother goes to the Gestapo, which was like the FBI. It was the national police. And yes, he is being detained in Dachau. How long? Who knows? And so naturally, right away, you get a lawyer, and they couldn't do anything. You also have to know that the enormous majority of the Austrians loved the idea of Hitler. They loved him. He gave them jobs. He gave them property. He built a highway east-west, the Autobahn was started at that time. He built the Volkswagen, which was supposed to be for the people. And he defied the League of Nations by building tanks and planes. And, we figured that the British and the French weren't going to do anything. The United States is way too far away. What are they going to do to me? They didn't do anything when he walked into Austria. Why would they do anything now? And he made a pact with Mussolini at that time, so he was covered on the southern flank. And eventually made a pact with Japan, so that became the Axis. When he didn't come out, every month you were allowed to write one postcard. And a photostat of that is the last thing that I have, and the only thing that I have left from his time in the concentration camp. It's the only thing. He burnt everything when he got out. He didn't want anything to remind him of it.
How did he get out?
A good story. when he was there, what he did, he wrote a postcard in the beginning of December, and in the postcard it says, "Go to see Uncle Simon, and Merry Christmas, and Sandit Herman," which means go to the United States. So we contacted Simon Jonas, and he didn't have any money. I mean, he had a little auto store, and his brother-in-law had a little had a money, but he wasn't going to help. So he went to one of his son-in-laws, Martin.
Uncle Simon went.
Yes, Martin Tiernauer. It's a Pittsburgh family. His wife was Simon's daughter, and he didn't have any money either. I mean, he had a job. He was a salesman, and who went to his boss, a Gentile. And he said, "I have this cousin in Europe. I need someone to sign for him. And I need someone who has property who can sign this affidavit." He's a Gentile man, and he did. Hmm. And
do you know his name?
I don't.
All right.
But Martin Tiernauer is still living. He's deep in his 90s. Hmm. And Frida, his wife, live in California.
How do you spell Tiernauer?
T-Y-R-N-A-U-E-R.
A-U-E-R.
Did I get it right?
Yes.
Right.
Thank you.
And that is, that's right. So he signed the affidavit and we came over.
Without your father?
Without my father. My mother, my sister, and I, we packed up all the belongings from the house that we had in the city. We had another place in Karlsbad, but that was in Czechoslovakia. It was like a resort, and they used to go there every summer for their baths, you know, mineral baths. And we forgot about all that, and it just left. And the only thing we brought along were really furniture, clothes, and a few diamonds, and I mean, that you could, you know, smuggle in. When we came here, nobody would believe that Herman was in jail for no good reason at all. See, American Jews wouldn't believe it. His own uncle said, "You know, Sabina, you know, what did Herman do that he's in jail? Well, go explain to him that they don't have to have a reason." But nobody would believe it, and there was no reason to believe it. And Izzy Binstock, who I'm sure you know,
well,
he is in the family. His mother was Fremcha, Frida, and she and her sister was Simon Jonas's first wife. So naturally he became the lawyer. And he went to the congressman of this area, whose name was Eberharter, who was not Jewish, but of German descent. And he explained to him that this man is here, this man's family is here, he is being held in a jail in Germany, and why? And this congressman, being of German descent, was somewhat embarrassed by this. Don't forget, there were still diplomatic relations. And he said, "I will find out," and he talked to Berlin or whatever it was. But the upshot is, they released him.
Mm-hmm. The first one of its kind I ever heard of.
They released him in June. When he went back to Vienna, he stayed only one night and at a hotel. His ticket was there, his exit visa was there, affidavit was in order, so all he had to do is spend one night in Vienna and get on the train, go to Paris and Le Havre and take the Queen Mary and come over. Since you couldn't take any money out, you went first class. We all went first class. Why not? You can't take the money. So you could write a check, you know, and spend it that way, but you couldn't take it out. that night, that first night in Vienna, a SS man who was also Gestapo saw him on the street and recognized him. He looked terrible. He lost 50 pounds. He was beaten, and one side of his head was bashed in, and he couldn't hear on the right side after that. But he said to him, "Herman, you look terrible. Why do you look so bad?" He said, he was afraid to tell him. He said, "I've been away." He says, "Where have you been?" He says, "I've just been away. I was in Germany." And this SS man knew about the camps. And so he gave him $20, which was like $20. He says, "Here, go out and have a good meal." And my father was afraid to take it, figuring that this was going to be like
entanglement.
Yes, that he was bribing him or something, and then he would pick him up and take him in. And he wouldn't take it, and he said, "No, no." They knew each other from the studio was in the 15th district, and they knew each other from there. He says, "No, take it. I want you to have it." And he took it. And he did go out and did have a meal. After the war, my father looked up this man. And it was my job to make a package every month of coffee and sugar and Crisco and all the stuff that you couldn't get. And we would send him a package every month. There were very few that were really concerned. Because Hitler gave them, they gave them a whole future, you know. The Treaty of Versailles kept Germany so in almost in bondage, economic bondage, that when Hitler came along and said, "Look, I'm going to make you great again," it sounded really good that Roosevelt made us great again, right? Okay. So when he came over, it was about June or July of 39. At that time, we were living at my aunt's house in Hazelwood, 149 Hazelwood Avenue. And the auto store was right on 2nd Avenue. And he had nothing. You know, he had his clothes, but no cameras, nothing. So he went to his old boss from 1920, and he said to him, "Do you think you could have my job back?" And he said, "Sure." And he gave him his job back. He gave him $15 a week. And we moved to Murray Avenue, 2326 Murray Avenue, on the second floor. And immediately, my father started to try to do other work besides the one that he was working during the day. His boss's name was Clarence Burley, had a studio on Penn Avenue in East Liberty, second floor, 6016 Penn Avenue. Clarence Burley had bought O.C. Henry's studio. O.C. Henry was one of the finest studios in the city. He, along with a fellow named W.R. Johnson, were the best photographers. And Clarence Burley, you know, today he had a lot of money. Today he wanted to be a photographer, tomorrow he wanted to be this. So when he wanted to be a photographer, he hired my father, and he hired a woman named Amelia Deakin, D-E-A-K-I-N. Who came from a socially prominent Pittsburgh family, but no money. Didn't have any money, but had all the social contacts. So, and Clarence Burley, coming from old Pittsburgh society, and my father being a good photographer, the combination worked. And then Burley got tired of it. A year later, about 1941, And he said to my dad and the receptionist, "How would you like to buy this? I don't want to be in the business anymore." So my father went to the Hebrew Free Loan Society and borrowed $250. And he and this woman bought the studio and as a partnership. And it went under Jonas Deacon. And then the war broke out, and Mrs. Deacon's husband was a retired colonel in the United States Army. And he was called back into the service because of the war. And as with every partner, as with some partnerships, everybody thought that I'm doing more than you are, and they split. She opened a studio in the Carlton House in town, or before that, I think she was on Oliver Avenue, and he stayed in East Liberty. And worked 18 hours a day. And build it up into something quite suitable.
End of side one, tape one, to be continued on.